All right. We're going to move to discussing access to medicine. And our next speaker is Brandon Pfeffercorn, Dr. Brandon Pfeffercorn. He's a 2008 graduate of the MD program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, where he's now pursuing an MPH. His interest in access to medicine stems in part from travel to Uganda and previous experience in retail pharmacy. He's a former member of the National Coordinating Committee for the nonprofit group Universities Allied for Essential Medicine.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you today. I'm going to share some of our experiences with a student group at the University of Wisconsin. Starting with the requisite slide, I have no relationships to disclose. So I'd like to talk first and just lay the stage. What is the problem of access to medicines? And then talk about the role universities can play in helping to ensure access. Using the case study from the University of Wisconsin and a situation we had there, and then talk about the role provisions known as humanitarian licensing might play in making sure that those issues with access do not happen, and then finally just provide some recommendations based on our experience. So the problem of access to medicines, and this is a very simplistic slide just to lay the groundwork, medicines do not always reach those in need. That's the problem, obviously. And counterbalancing that is that industry who have developed these medicines need to recoup their expenses. And so this leads to a fundamental conflict between the ideas of market justice and the ideas of social justice. How do we make sure that the companies are recouping their benefits or their investments without negatively impacting access, which is what I talk about there. The scope of the problem, this is from the World Health Organization, they estimate 25 to 66% of healthcare spending in developing nations is on pharmaceuticals, with pharmaceuticals being the largest expense for some poor households in developing nations. And they also estimate that interventions involving essential medicines could save as many as 10 million lives per year by the year 2015. Just to give a broad overview of the drug development process, the discovery end on the left side as you're facing it is where universities are really involved. They're finding the compounds that are ultimately developed into the products that we know on the market. And so then it goes through the pre-development phase, the development phase, and finally to patients. And so we talk about three points where access can be inhibited. The first is, which is labeled gap one here, where the basic research has been published, but there isn't an effort to pursue further development of the product. Gap two is where you have a validated candidate drug, you have something that looks promising, might work, but it's not taken into clinical development for a number of reasons, and it's just labeled here as profit-based company choices. Perhaps the market isn't there, perhaps it's a complicated process. And finally, the one that I'm going to talk about today is gap three, where drugs never reach the patient. And they list here registration problems, a lack of production, high prices, which is something I'm going to talk about, or drugs poorly adapted to local conditions. I'd like to give a little background on our organization to set the stage for the rest of the talk. It is a nonprofit organization known as Universities Allied for Essential Medicines. It was founded and is maintained by students of law, medicine, public health, public policy, among other disciplines. The mission is really two parts. One, to make sure that university products get out to all those who need them. And second, to increase university research on neglected diseases, recognizing that that's an important part of the access problem. So why universities? And I think some of these numbers help to illustrate the scope of the issue. And these are numbers from the Association of University Technology Managers from the fiscal year 2006, which is the last one that's available. In that year, there were almost 19,000 new invention disclosures on which about 16,000 patent applications were filed. They ended up getting about 3,000 patents that year, which resulted in 5,000 licenses. So I think this is an important point to make. Universities take out the patent on the product, and then we'll license it out to companies for further development. And so this is the point we're talking at, about, where universities have filed for patents and now are licensing out the technology to companies. And how do we look at that process and start right from the very beginning sort of circumventing the access problem? And then ultimately, in that year, there were a little better than 12,000 licenses and other options that were yielding active income for universities, which also becomes a powerful financial incentive. So then the other question is, well, do universities really make things that matter? And I think this slide is a brief example of products that we would all say are important in treatment around the world. So we list about five HIV/AIDS medications developed at universities, the first one being D4T. The fight over access was what led to the founding of our student group. And then looking at some other current topics, the HPV vaccine is currently being worked on in the second and third generation formulations at Georgetown, and our group has played a role in helping to make sure that access provisions are included from the beginning in those new vaccines. And then turning towards some other chronic diseases, cancer, hepatitis, and looking at products that come out of universities. And finally, from our institution, a drug known as Zemplar, which is a vitamin D product, a synthetic vitamin D used in chronic kidney disease, which is what I'm going to talk about a little more here. And then to lay the background, universities have designated technology transfer organizations. Ours is known as the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. It was the first in the nation, and so is the oldest. And their mission is in two parts, to move inventions, this is from their website, by the way, moving inventions arising from the university's laboratories to the marketplace for the benefit of the university, the inventors, and society, and carefully managing an endowment that WARF has grown since its inception. And this is also an important point under financial incentives, because the Alumni Research Foundation has funded, in part, all the construction of every research building on campus. And then to give just a very brief overview of Zemplar and how we've gotten involved at the University of Wisconsin. As background, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, Thailand began negotiating with pharmaceutical companies to bring down the price of medicines. At some point in the early 2000s, they instituted a national health insurance program and were realizing that in order to cover the expenses of providing medication for everyone, the prices would have to come down. Those negotiations were ultimately unsuccessful, and so Thailand issued what are known as compulsory licenses. I would imagine most people are familiar with that concept, but essentially turning over the right to manufacture the product to other companies at a lower price. There were three companies that were affected. One of them is Abbott Laboratories, and they were perhaps the most stringent in their response. And they took seven medications that had been on that they had applied for registration on the Thai market and withdrew those applications. And one of those drugs was Zemplar. And so that's how we get this tie from the government of Thailand to the University of Wisconsin. The inventor of Zemplar is Dr. Hector DeLuca, and he had been getting emails from nephrologists, kidney doctors in Thailand who were saying, you know, why don't we have this medication anymore? And so he took the step of writing to Abbott, and he said, I believe it is unfortunate that patients anywhere in the world are denied this wonderful drug because of political reasons. And I urge you to do everything you can to see to it that this medication is made available in Thailand and any other country where patients are suffering. And so our student group took this information. We had found out that he had wrote this letter and went to the Alumni Foundation and said, there's a problem here. We need to figure out how to fix this access problem. And our ultimate goal was for them to step up and say, we are committed to making sure everybody in the world has access to this product. It was developed here. It deserves to be out in the market. And we wanted them to issue a public call to Abbott to respond to this. And they basically said, well, we've talked to Abbott. They said it's available. And really, we couldn't get much farther in those negotiations. And so we went back and we said, okay, well, let's see what we can find out. So this is from Abbott in Thailand. Obviously, most of us don't understand what it says, but you can see the four formulations of Zemplar. This is the list of medications that were withdrawn from registration. And also from the Thai Food and Drug Administration to a member of our organization, noting that Zemplar was unavailable in Thailand as of June 11th, 2007, this is. So the next step was to try to push on the Alumni Foundation and get them to respond to this. These are members of our student group on the bottom here, campaigning on campus. So this is April 2007 for the timeline. We provided information, evidence, letters of support. We had a local, longtime serving state senator to sign on to our campaign, and really got what we felt was a pretty unsatisfactory response from the Research Foundation, and I'll show that in just a minute. And so this next step in our campaign is just to get the word out and let everybody know what they've done. So we've published an editorial in the Boston Globe. We have had articles in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I had an editorial in the Wisconsin State Journal, which is our local paper. I've presented this talk, a similar talk, at the American Medical Student Association, and finally spreading the word on the national stage to draw attention to what's going on. This is the response from the Alumni Foundation, dated May 8, 2007, and it really was in sort of three parts. They started by saying, well, Abbott Laboratories is a good friend and actually has its own UW alumni chapter, which was concerning right from the start. The second point was, I think, perhaps the most ignorant response we could have anticipated, where they said, well, the government of Thailand just had a coup, and this is a military government, and those negotiations are difficult, which is perhaps true, but not reflective of the situation. These negotiations had been going on for, I think, the better part of a decade, and just reflected incomplete understanding of the situation, to put it lightly. And finally, they said, we trust that Abbott Laboratories is committed to doing its part to meet the health needs of people around the world, including Thailand, and we support Abbott in that commitment. Yeah. And so I'd like to talk then just quickly about conflicting pressures on universities, because I think that letter illustrates some of these points. One is that universities are members of other trade organizations, one being the Association of University Technology Managers, which is then itself a member of a group called the Biotechnology Industry Organization. And BIO, or the Biotech Industry Organization, has pushed for pretty strict IP regulation, regulation that we would argue runs counter to the mission of universities, as well as pressure from the Office of the United States Trade Representative, which is some of what we heard earlier this morning. We would also say that universities are uniquely sensitive to pressure from faculty, staff, students, and taxpayers, importantly, and finally, hopefully, from advocacy and other nonprofit groups. So humanitarian licensing as a concept, I'm just going to talk briefly about this as we've sort of talked about it all along. Some other terms, we have a model equitable access license for universities to consider. It's also sometimes known as global access licensing. And this is from our website now. When an access gap with respect to a health product derived from university research is identified in a particular country, the humanitarian licensing provisions would strip out, any patent, regulatory, or production barriers. And I think those are the three things, as we saw in GAP 3, three important categories of problems for access. And finally, some national recognition that we got last year on this concept was the 2008 Democratic National Convention platform, which included the language, we also support the adoption of humanitarian licensing policies that ensure medications developed with U.S. taxpayer dollars are available off-patent in developing countries. I think this illustrates some important points, one being that these inventions are funded with taxpayer dollars, and so universities are responsive to citizens. And finally, some recommendations. The first would be simply be aware of what your university's research products are. As we saw from that list, there are a number of medications that would be of help in developing nations. The second being to be aware of your university's technology transfer policies. and to shape them and hold them accountable to what they espouse. And then to ensure global access, as we see in public health, the proactive measures tend to, would seem to work the best. And so looking at how can we include from the beginning licensing provisions that would take effect if an access gap is identified. And finally, we need to know, is this the best way to do this? Are humanitarian licensing provisions going to play an important role in the access problem? Because I don't know that we know that just yet. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions.
We do have 5 minutes for questions. And also, I'd like to point out we have a trade and health forum sign up sheet. I think it's going on there somewhere. Does anybody actually have it? Or we can keep circulating. I think some people have locked in. So we have questions.
This is such a great campaign. I mean, it's really well thought out, and I think it's really activated a lot of public health and law and medicine students around the country. So really always interesting to hear about the work. I assume there was no further progress on that particular product, or has anything else occurred?
Yeah, so the question is about future or further progress in the campaign, and I haven't heard that anything has happened. It's been difficult to get good information about what's going on, and I think, as this illustrates, difficult to get good information as it was going on, whether there was access. I do know that Abbott did register a pediatric version of one of the HIV AIDS medications, Keletra, that was under negotiations. I don't know that there have been subsequent registrations. There was a lot of back and forth on Abbott continued to lower the price with the provision that the government of Thailand withdraw their use of compulsory licenses. And I think they ultimately, on the part of Thailand, held up and said, no, we're not going to do that, which was an interesting. That they would not withdraw their compulsory licenses. Yeah. Yeah. Any question?
Yeah, how important a revenue source is this for the university? I mean, beyond noble intellectual pursuits, I'm sure this must play, especially now in a time of economic crisis, a big role. And so I'm wondering if there's a way to at least understand the issue and if there's a way to...
So I'm going to sort of answer your question in a roundabout way. The question was about what role this revenue source plays in universities. And I think... it's an increasing part of the purview of technology transfer organizations. And I think there have been a couple of blockbuster cases, one being, I was just reading about this botulinum toxin, Botox, which was developed at the University of Wisconsin in part, but never patented because there didn't seem to be a market. And so I think the fear has been that you're going to have those situations. And so they've been trying to be more strict from the beginning in maintaining control over their intellectual property with the fear that ultimately they're going to look silly. And it's hard to get a good answer as to what percentage of financing comes from this. The Alumni Foundation, as I mentioned, gives grants for every building on campus. As well, they give grants for general research. So it is an important source of funding. A question in the back.
Yeah, I was in Thailand over the summer. I'm an adjunct professor at Chulalongkorn University. My understanding from my colleagues were that Abbott did not pursue the licensing of any of the products.
I didn't do the last part.
None of them. The 8 products are not available in Thailand.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's good to know. So the comment was that the government of, or the Abbott has not registered the products in Thailand.
And also to dispel the myth of the military junta having that, the democratic elected government assembly, the Thaksin lookalike, Bush Thaksin lookalike, they maintain it and they're staunchly committed to the Abbott is completely in an atavistic position and held off on their side. Not working with the government in any way, shape, or form.
Just one final comment. I have copies of the handouts of these slides if anybody would like. There's some in the back. I also have some up here, as well as just a short paper I wrote about the situation if anybody would like to read more.
Okay. Thank you.